to Mrs. Carroll's. You remember Mrs. Carroll, of course. Who lived across the river, across the Willamette on the other side, and I'd take my little bicycle and I'd go along. And I'd always stop on the bridge, on the Broadway Bridge, and look down the river. And as far as you could see were the masts of ships, three masters, four masters. The three masters were the common ones. Ships taking wood and salmon and things like that to the Orient and all around the world. And there was only one steamboat. There was a line that had three steamboats, the Alaska, the Bear, and they ran up to Alaska. The Alaska, the Beaver, and the Bear. They all sank later. But the thing is that here was along the waterfront in Portland, Oregon, there, as far as you could see, were the masts of ships. And all of a sudden, they were gone. There were no more three masters. They just went like that. I used to be very good at making imitations of them. You'd work with them in wood, and I had some good three masters and so forth. The whole thing, this was a... And, of course, right next to it, it's still there, is the station, and there were the steam engines, which were so exciting to watch. Well, they have gone too. And they went just in 1 year. The whole thing just disappeared for an entirely new culture, if we'd call it a culture. And at Sausalito later, when I was at Berkeley, you'd see the same mass of ships, but they were the salmon ships that would come down at winter at Sausalito and then go up to, and students would get jobs on them, and they'd go up to Alaska for the summertime. And then again, all these masts, and all of a sudden, about 1939, 40, they disappeared and there were no more of them. Everything has just gone away like that. You might say it's sort of sad. And speaking of the salmon herring, this is typical. For thousands of years, the main food of Europe was herring. It was required by the church. Of course, you had to have fish on Friday. And so the greatest market in the food market in the world was the herring market at the Baltic. That's what made the glory of the Hansa, the great Hansa cities, the great merchant cities that still remain. They were the basis of the economy of Europe in the Middle Ages, were the so-called Hansa. I should be asking you, what are the Hansa and so forth? What were the main Hansa cities? Hansa, Bremen, Lübeck, Danzig, and so forth. But we got awfully good in the last few years at fishing here, and very efficient. They had electronic devices for discovering the schools of fish, the vast schools. Then they had nets 10, 20 miles long for scooping them up. Then they had floating factories for processing them while they were still on the water. And it was wonderful. They got more and more efficient at the herring. And then suddenly, one day, about 10 years ago, there were no more herring. For all those thousands of years, not one herring left, not one. The whole center of the Baltic now, more than a third of the Baltic Sea, is not just without herring, it's without anything. There's no life in it whatever. It is nothing but algae. Just blue-green algae, the Carilla bacteria, they call them, cyanobacteria, that eat everything up, including the oxygen, and so there's nothing left. It's now a dead sea, just enough. And it didn't happen in 1,000 years. So I would recommend you, I just picked it up as I left the house, the June issue of the National Geographic. No, the theme is extermination, the march toward extermination. And this is one of those great periods of extermination. I mention this because this is the theme of the Book of Mormon, in which the word destruction appears 354 times. Destruction, destroy. Well, that's a discouraging sort of thing, you see. The Book of Mormon is as upbeat as its downbeat. But let me refer you to this. Now, we say this is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. These are the latter days. This is the end. This is the final time. These are the last days. The last days of what, you see? Well, the last days of a lot of things on which we're depending. But I think this would be an interesting thing to refer to. Let me talk about this now. I say this last geographic. It tells us, now, all the years I was teaching things, and since it was ancient history and stuff like that, there was lots of reverence to evolution, a slow, gradual procession, slow, gradual, relentless, infinitely slow, perfectly regular. That was the old Victorian idea, steady, reliable. That's all gone now. You don't talk about evolution that way, as the man says here. Well, now, this has happened. This talks about the capture of the last California condor. And it says, during the same time, since the 1930s, as many as 100 acres a minute of the world's tropical forests among the most richly populated inhabitants of Earth have been destroyed. 100 acres a minute goes on. An estimated million species will be lost in the next 25 years at the rate of a species every 15 minutes. Every 15 minutes, a species that existed for thousands of years will disappear forever. Well, we obviously are living at the end of an age when things are going to change. We have to do something about it. what's the handbook? What do we do? I panic when I read things like this. Then one answer comes, the Book of Mormon. Now, you think that may think that's a paradox, but it isn't. We'll see what the Book of Mormon is going to tell us. Then it goes on. Well, then it talks about other extinctions that have taken place. The first one is that discovered by the Alvareses of Berkeley 66 million years ago. The big question was why the dinosaurs suddenly disappeared, and we know now that there were hundreds of varieties, and great varieties, great adaption. They showed great adaptability. They could fit into almost any environment, but all of a sudden they just vanished. That's because the Earth got socked by a meteorite or a giant meteorite or a comet, and there was nothing you could do about it. But at any rate, at one time, 60% to 80% of animal species disappeared. I, as long as ago as the in this class, in was 1965 or 56, I can't remember. I guess it was 56, when Wolfgang Schindel, when Schindelwolf, was it? Oh, Schindelwolf, yes. When Schindelwolf introduced his neocatastrophism, everybody took it lightly then, but they don't anymore. They took it more seriously. Namely, there are certain periods when you find, before a certain day, before a certain time, a vast variety of creatures are flourishing, and then they suddenly disappear. You don't find them anymore in the strata above that. But you find totally different, suddenly appearing. Now, what happens there? Well, you see what happens. The theories, there are various theories. The Earth gets socked by a meteorite. It jars the Earth, its magnetic field. It breaks down the magnetic shield, which comes from the North Pole and surrounds the Earth. The Van Allen belts and so forth, which allows radiation to come in from the sun, solar radiation, and stellar radiation, which allow cosmic rays to reach from one side and solar rays to reach from the other. They come together. And they both have the effect of breaking down our genes and cells and having us produce all sorts of freaks and odd growths. You know, you jokes about this sort of thing because of radiation, it suddenly new types and species develop. Well, this is one of the theories and so forth, but the point is now that things do get destroyed. They get destroyed suddenly. When a certain period comes, that's the end, and we have been warned of it here. Now, it says at least 12 mass extinctions have taken place, at least 12 of them. The mass extinction concept, notice this isn't something I taught during the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s at Claremont and Berkeley and places like that. But always, we never dreamed of anything like this. And then it says, in the 1980s, it says, the concept has hit science like a fireball during the 1980s. I never expected anything like that. The great dyings have remained obscure. We don't know why. All this is changing, we used to say. The fossil record was too imprecise, but all this is changing now. The rules of evolution are being rewritten. This is just the last issue, June issue. You see, it's Geographic, very, very recent, you see. But all the rules, and this is the thing we all used to argue about here, go round and round about evolution. I thought it was a waste of time. Never engaged in those arguments. But no, because dealing with human history within its time, there's no evolution at all. We talk about the KT boundary. That's the Crito-Tertiary, or the Cretaceous and Tertiary. At that time, between the Cretaceous and the Cretaceous is the dinosaurs, and you go out and look in these Morrison deposits, this blue-green stuff you find all over Utah. That's where the dinosaurs are, and out of that you won't find anything after that. Well, they were all wiped up. So they call that the KT boundary, when you move from the Cretaceous to all these strange creatures that belong. This isn't in our creation story. This doesn't belong to our story. This Genesis isn't concerned with this. This isn't where Adam comes in. These are other creatures here. Remember, we believe in the gospel and we preach other things. And Joseph Smith's teachings are much more explicit on this than we realize because we get into them more today. Namely, that the whole universe is multiple use, and so is the Earth, multiple use. There are creatures on the Earth that we know nothing about, that don't concern us, that have nothing to do with our affairs. We have our own things to concern us. Adam had his family, and we're his people, and his history is our history. But there are other histories that have nothing to do with him. See, and that shouldn't disturb us at all, the idea that there should be anything else beside us. But this is very clear here, what's happening here. Most scientists now concur that at least one great extraterrestrial object struck the planet around the time the dinosaurs died out. There's lots of diagrams and pictures here, very nice. Here's the description. It's a very apocalyptic description. It's what we read in the apocalypses of the scriptures. And you will recognize these things. Book of Mormon here. In the first days after the earth was hit, dust blanketed the entire world. It grew pitch dark for from 1 to 3 months. Well, remember in the Book of Mormon, it was the local upheaval, but it's the one that wiped out Nephite civilization, and the people could feel the darkness. There was them. They couldn't strike a light. It was so heavy. That sort of thing, the same sort of thing causing it. Could be meteoric or volcanic. The two go together, actually. Excuse me. Well, that's the worst of it. Semesters always begin in the spring and in the autumn when I have my allergies, so I have to put up with that. The impact on the land, they probably got bitter cold, and then it says, the entire world caught fire, and of course this is apocalyptic, the earth going up in flames and so forth. This is actually what happened. It says, it talks about Yellowstone, it says that's nothing. That day, 66 million years ago, when the earth was hit, the entire world caught fire. To get the amount of soot we find, that is distributed throughout the world at a certain level between these two deposits, the Cretaceous and the Tertiary. To get the amount of soot, as much as 90% of the world's forest must have been burned. Well, we're taking care of that now. The fireball would have had a ratio of several thousand kilometers. Winds hundreds of kilometers an hour would have swept the planet for hours, drawing trees like giant hair, 2,000-degree rock vapor, lightning discharges like those of volcanic eruption. It's on a much greater scale, but high, and a much greater scale than that in the Book of Mormon, of course. But you notice it follows the same pattern. The same sorts of things are happening. Very depressing, very alarming here, you see, of course, we can contrast. Now, he says, such doomsday scenarios strain our belief. But mass extinctions do occur. They force a new perspective on the history of life. They also force a new perspective on history, as I said before. Here we have 1200 B.C. when Troy fell. That should concern us, because that great tragedy when Virgil heaves that great sigh and says, sunt lacrimae ret mem tem mortalia tangit. Who was it? It was Matthew Arnold who said, that's the most moving, the most tragic line in history. Because when we read that, he says, we're all in the same boat. You can't help crying when you read that. Because there are these times when this hits. Then in Lehi's time, the same thing hit again. That was the other great, what Jasper's called the, I guess we should be writing things on the board, the year 600 was the pivotal period. Well, we wrote all about this in that book called An Approach to the Book of Mormon. That used to be a priesthood manual, 1957. And introduces you to a lot of things like that, because An Approach to the Book of Mormon. It's not compulsory, be sure of that. And then it goes on. They do occur. And when it strikes, it's not necessarily the most fit that survive. Well, this is the interesting thing, of course. Who survives? The problem of the Book of Mormon is survival. Remember, you always have the one man against the world, whether it's Alma or whether it's Ammon or whether it's Jared or whether it's Lehi or whether it's Alma. You always have the one man, or whether right at the end there, of course, you have Mormon and Moroni. And who plans the survival and so forth? But survival is a tragic word. We use it too much. Survival is a dirty word as far as I'm concerned, because it means I stay here while everybody else is wiped out. John Chrysostom, you all know who John Chrysostom was. He's called Golden Mouth because he was the greatest Christian orator of the 4th and 5th centuries. And he handed on a lot of very interesting doctrine. But he was in Antioch at the time of the great earthquake, which destroyed the city utterly and completely. It was after the time of Christ this happened, you see. Same sort of thing happened then. These things come in periods. There'll be a long, stable period, just as we have in the weather and so on. When everything is perfect, everything seems to be going nice, and we get the idea that this is the normal order of things, and a nice, safe Victorian world in which things gradually, by imperceptible degrees, work toward betterment. They work toward the better, because that's what evolution is. Since the fittest survive, the better people are those that come through, and so the world gets better and better, and it's wonderful. Well, but it doesn't work that way. And whatever I was talking about, I better get on here now. What was I going to say? I'll think of it anyway. It's not necessarily the most fit that survive, and they don't. Oh, here's my picture. So we go on. And mass extinctions, let's promote new beginnings. Well, that's the purpose of them. The Lord wipes the old slate clean, and then he brings more on. This is a principle stated again and again in the Book of Mormon. When the cup is full, can't be filled any farther, you can't be diluted, nothing to do about it. When the fruit is ripe, there's no point to letting it ripen anymore. Then, this is the promise on this land here, then the Lord will cause extinction. They will be utterly destroyed, he says. Be utterly removed. That's the word the Book of Mormon used. They will be, remember after the winning of a great battle, the Nephites were celebrating, and Alma had to tell them, I'm sorry, you will become extinct. 400 years from now, you will become extinct. That's the word he uses, if you are wicked. But the Lord takes care of these things in order to supplant them. Remember, he says in the Book of Mormon, the Lord leads away the righteous into precious lands, and the wicked he destroys. How you get out of it? Well, it's the story of Abraham, the story of the children of Israel and Moses and so forth. Because remember, Moses's migrations took place during great world upheavals of the same kind. That's the 1200s. See, that's the same time that Troy was destroyed, and that the Israelites went out of Egypt into Palestine. So it says here, and so that's what happened. The best evidence of the greatest extinction of all, that's the Permian extinction, in which 94% of all life on Earth was extinguished. Ooh, that was a great one. Is in Utah's House Range, east of here, west of here, the House Range, which is now, this is an ironical thing, it is the best evidence we have for the worst extinction that ever took place in the world, it tells us in this article here. The first mass extinction, the worst, it was a terror. What they're practicing there now, it's been turned over now as a range, but there's been much discussion, the ranchers are protesting and so forth. They're not doing any good because the Air Force is going to have it, and they're going to use it as a range to practice mass extinction, including biological warfare. See? We're practicing mass extinction out there now. See, the clock comes full curve here, full circle. And we suddenly, well, and then some other things. Reef life, it evolves anew after each of these. Boy, this is very sad. This is one of these extinctions, the Fresnian. Thin yellow sulfur mineral testifies its existence everywhere. Precipitated oxygen suddenly vanished from the upper layers of the ocean. 70% of the invertebrates perished there. The seas would have looked like the aftermath of a global red tide, dead animals floating everywhere. Oh, boy. This is a cheerful beginning for our class, isn't it? But we're starting with the Book of Mormon. If you have tears, prepare to shed them now, which should be our opening. You all know that line, don't you? You know that line. Antony's speech, of course. You all had Julius Caesar in high school, at least, didn't you? Well, all right, if you have tears, prepare to shed them now. I knew Caesar, yes. And how long did it take? Well, could it take 20,000 years, it said here, but this is what he says, but maybe just one stormy night. That's how long it took in the Nephite story, you know, before the coming of Christ. Just one stormy night, wipe out 70% of the life on Earth. Well, that must be some show. Great swings of the sea wind. In Nevada, I remember going on a field trip with Brother Bissell many years ago when I first came here. We saw these things in Nevada. Huge boulders of coastal rock from the coast carried right across Utah, huge, enormous boulders. And then these fracture points when they're up Spanish Fork Canyon where they smash against other rocks. The violence of the thing must have been inconceivable. And so, I was wrong, it wasn't 94%. The Permian was the greatest extinction, perhaps 96% of all species disappeared. That's something. So, and it made for, these terrible things that happened. A profound and mysterious crisis struck at the end of the Jurassic. There you go again. We still don't know the explanation. Because the flowers, the angiosperm, suddenly took over with explosive rapidity. That's a thing we often talk about in class, not now though. Due to overgrazing and so forth. It was because the dinosaurian overgrazing threatened many growing plants, but the angiosperms were able to escape it. Those are the seed pod plants and so forth. And so, what do we have here now? A plague of little animals, little Asian animals, invaded North America, and they ate the last of the dinosaurs out of house and home. They didn't have anything to eat on. There's another theory, you see. The cruelest Cretaceous tertiary extinction struck the seas. All large marine reptiles also vanished. Ammonoids, the lovely coiled curved survivor, died out completely, and they were once the big thing. And then, again, we talk about this. Remember, this goes with the Doctrine and Covenants class as much as anything, because it talks about the showers of stars and meteors. This is a very important thing. It goes with them. The Earth was hit not by one great object, but rather by showers of comets. Stars fall from the heavens. That bombarded the Earth over several million years. And this is how they're trying to explain it now. It's a scary sort of thing, too. When the comets struck the seas, generating tsunamis, overturns the deep anoxic or toxic waters. The tsunamis, the tidal waves that drowned so many cities on the coast in the Book of Mormon when the great destruction came. They were caught in tidal waves. The final terminating impact, as Calvin, that occurred on the land were produced firestorms, soot, and a pall of dust. And we, of course, there shall be a vapor of smoke, and it shall cover the earth, says the Book of Mormon. So we have, this is on schedule. As long as we're on, it might say that this thing is scheduled every 26 million years. We have these things happen. What could that be? Well, there are two theories. There is one of the Oort cloud between Pluto and all this Neptune stuff. See how it's caught us by surprise overnight? Between them is a cloud of a massive stuff circulating on an almost galactic scale. And every 26 years, million years, in the sun's course around the galaxy, we pass through that in a regular trend. And then we get showered by this stuff and it knocks everything galley west. The other thing is that the Earth has a companion star, the sun has a companion star, a dark star we can't see a great distance. They go around each other every 26 million years, and they call that Nemesis. They give it the name of Nemesis. The Nemesis brings with it a cloud of planets and its own dust and stuff. And when we pass through all that stuff, then we get showered, and then we get plastered again. So this is the picture you see. A dense cloud of comets that astronomers believe surrounds our solar system. Something could periodically unsettle that cloud and fling battalions of comets, and it could be the Nemesis or the Oort cloud. See, they don't mention that here. Well, a star orbiting our sun, a tenth planet, our solar system, moves periodically through a star-dense spiral. Between 35 and 40 million years ago, a well-documented chilling of the seas did all the killing. It would still be a shower again. Well, this is coming quite recently now. Now we're surely in one day. Whether or not we fit a cosmic timetable for an extinction, we surely are in one today. We're in a period of extinction today, is what it's telling us now. In North America, about 11,000 years ago, which is that late, there was a that early, there was a brilliant culture flourishing in the Balkans. Now, we won't go into the chronology of the Bible now, as far as that goes. But 3,000-4,000 years before the pyramids, there the Varna culture and the people in the center of the Balkans, where they have, well, they've discovered 36,000 artifacts, temples, marvelous sculpture and so forth, wonderful metalwork, fabulous minds, deep minds there. It was amazing. But at the same time, almost the same time as these creatures, because this would make it only 9,000 BC, and it was there then. It reaches its peak between 8 and 7,000 BC, that particular civilization. But here, in North America, about 11,000 years ago, most large animals were wiped out. All perished abruptly. What happened? And by abruptly, I mean, you know about the stories of the mammoths found with undigested buttercups in their stomachs and so forth, which means they must have been frozen very, very fast. It takes 3 hours to thaw a turkey. And how long would it take to freeze a mammoth, you know, so that the digestive processes wouldn't cause decay, gases, and all that sort of thing? And here we have fresh buttercups in these mammoths. And no, they're so fresh, you knew, but there was an industry in Siberia, in Tsarist Russia in the 80s and 90s, which sold this for dog food, which sold mammoth meat for dog food commercially. There was so much of this stuff. All perished abruptly. The extinctions were so rapid, within 500 to 1,000 years, that many scientists would suspect, or at least assist, a villain in the extinction, that man was the one who was responsible. He was the one who was responsible for that one. Now we come to ourselves, you see. Now, he says, in the plant group I studied, in 1930. 42% of them have become extinct since then, since 1930. Just this particular botanist just talking. A Somer, head of the Bishop Museum in Honolulu. And again, you only have to ask who buys the timber or beef these felled forests produce. Well, McDonald's does. No, they're the biggest market for the Brazilian jungles. Hawaii contains 27% of the endangered birds and plants. And so we go to these sad statistics from now. We can see the health of the species interconnected if we let it too, that if we let too many disappear, we will go too. We depend on this picture today. For the first time, a living organism can consciously do something to halt a mass extinction. And now this is a theme of the Book of Mormon, as I say. Extinction is 354 times. Yeah, 534 times, excuse me. 534 times the destruction is mentioned in the Book of Mormon. Well then, what else did I write this morning? The Book of Mormon is a purely religious document. In fact, it's the greatest religious document there is because it's the only one that answers the terrible question. I was going to bring on the new paperback. I practically require it. Richard Anderson's paperback on the three witnesses. It's come out now in paperback and it's available. That clinches things very tight, you know. You can't say this about, see, the terrible questions are, the questions that haunt everybody is, the Book of Mormon only can answer this as far as that goes, is this all there is, you see? Is there anything else? Well, we can talk about morals and we can talk about beauty and ethics and all this sort of thing and say that's religion, but that isn't what religion's interested in. We just want the answer to, well, that one question. When we die, is that all? Is there anything else? And so forth. What comes after that? And, of course, the answer comes with an angel from on high. Moroni, an angel from other worlds, from deep space, you might say, and it's more than that, from the immensity of space. He comes and personally delivers the book. And on top of that, you see, we have Joseph Smith's witness, and you have the three witnesses, and you have the eight witnesses. They saw it all their lives. They said the three left the church, as you know, vanity and injured pride in the light. They came back, and except for E.G. Williams, and they never denied their testimony. And of course, as soon as they left the church, all the newspaper reporters and ministers and others swarmed in, descended on them like locusts. Now you'll tell us the truth. Now you can tell us what really happened. And they did. They'll tell you what really happened. The angel came and showed us the plates. And that's what they told them. They could never shake them at all, any of them. Well, how do you explain that? Well, the great Edward Meyer says, we can only say that that was a hallucination. But there's a catch to that. The Book of Mormon is not a hallucination. Everything else. I've been reading this week about the Rosicrucians, a movement began in the 1614, 15, and 16, things start going. But they had their sacred books, and there have always been these groups of mystics and sectarians and others that have. They have. They produced a manifesto, which divided into two, one book called the Fama, and the other called the, not the dissertation, but the point is, they claim this book were delivered by angels. And, but when you read it, it's nonsense. There's nothing there. It doesn't have anything to say, except the usual commonplaces. We should behave and love each other and so forth. We know that. Excuse me. Well, the Book of Mormon is not that, you see. What we have here, nobody's ever been able to get around the witnesses, you see. And but it's harder to get around the book, you see. It's a solid, compact mass of statements, a package containing thousands of clues. None of the critics that have torn into it have read it with care, really. We haven't either. I mean, that's why Brother Benson says, let's start reading it for a change, I say. When I was a kid, we just read it because it was sort of romantic and so forth, and what did it have to do with things? It has to do with us today. So we have here this dazzling procession of vivid images, these marvelous vignettes, character studies, perfectly conceived and so forth. But like the Book of Mormon was dug up, remember? So it's a fossil. We're speaking about fossils here, and this Book of Mormon is a fossil. Well, fodder means to dig up, and fossil, you know what a fossa is, a ditch. A fossil is something that is dug up. The Book of Mormon is literally a fossil, because Joseph dug it up. He removed the rock, and he dug, and he found the book, and so forth. And as a fossil, that the written word has its most, is the most marvelous invention known to man, because every ancient document's a fossil, you see. This is fossilized thought here. When you find a fossil, it can tell you all sorts of things, but what does it depend on? It depends on you. You've got to bring all sorts of experience, knowledge, acumen to the subject and see what you can do with this thing. So what do you do when you have a fossil, literal fossil? The most marvelous invention of man, as Galileo and Arthur Clarke and others have told us, is the written word, of course, because it can do what nothing else can. It defeats time and place. And you see, when you dig up one of these fossils, they're talking in terms of millions of years, 66 millions of years, 40 million years ago. And the fossil is there, and it's just as fresh as it was when it finally hardened its last cooking. It comes down to us unchanged. The time doesn't, and time won't affect the written record either. Those golden plates could last for millions of years, as far as that goes, being gold and so forth. You have this, so they o'erleap time, and I've got to write, that reminds me of something. There. And space, too. It makes no difference with space. These things are thousands of years old. And here, it conveys not merely sounds and images. I was talking about the fall of Troy and so forth. This great tragedy that electrified the human race and that's come down to us, the two greatest epics of ours. Homer, of course, both the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you could include the Aeneid and others. It's left its memory and its mark with us, and it's just as vivid now, and that's why the actor could shed tears for Hecuba. It was just too sad. It was heartbreaking. He was playing the role of Hecuba. What was Hecuba to him? It was very much alive. So this is a marvelous thing that the written word can do that TV and nothing else can do. So you have to have all sorts of fancy equipment and everything for that. But what do you need to hand down a record for a million years to convey not only the names and the places and the dates and the events, but your most subtle nuances of thought? You can, because so much of that is great poetry that can move us now just as from the time it was written. And it comes down, what do you need? A surface to scratch on or something to scratch it with. Take a rock or a stick. If you can scratch it on, make a scratch enough, it'll be as deep as the indentations in a fossil, and it will last for a million years as far as that goes. So by the written word, you can o'erleap time and space and all the rest of it. And they're just as when you look at a fossil. It depends on, the geologist can tell you what kind of a creature it was, what its environment was, what it lived on, its habits, and so forth, just from that one, it can even be one bone. Of course, that's led to some very comical things, because we know some of the reconstructions of dinosaurs of 100, 150 years ago look very funny now. That isn't the way they looked at all. They didn't have enough bones. But if you have enough to go on, you don't need too much, you see. But a skillful geologist can look, or a paleontologist can look at a bone and tell you all about the creature. And it's the same thing in reading the Book of Mormon. You see, a written document, you have to go into it as far as that goes. It's like the flight of the bee. The act of reading has never been explained. It's a mystery. There's no reason why you should be able to do it. It's a strange thing. The classic example of that would be Arabic. Well, other Semitic languages in which you don't write any vowels, you don't have any punctuation of any kind, you don't have any capital letters to denote a personal name, you make no division between the words. Notice you put no vowels. Every word has just three consonants. And you just string these consonants along, and that's it. And usually it's badly written and covered with fly specks. So how can anyone possibly read it? And yet it can be read. And when people start improving on it by putting in the little shadis and the tashdids and so forth, and putting in the pointings to help us along, it becomes a nuisance. They take those away. We don't want those. They're a nuisance. We got used to reading this. But how can it be done? In theory, you have to know first what it's talking about. Then it goes. But if you don't, you can be in an awful state of things, and that's the condition with Egypt today. We do not know the point of view from which to read it. So it's so much, most of it still escapes us. And so, Egyptian's a good example of limitations of which men are not aware. We think we've translated the texts, and we've been deservedly tricked. A very recent study by Westendorf on that very subject, showing that we've missed entirely the point of Egyptian. I think that's so. So when we read the Book of Mormon, I say, we read it as if we were picking our way through a minefield, missing 99% of the message. Are we even aware of the main points? Now, we start with the 46th chapter, which just like starting in the middle of a sentence. We can't do that. So I had to go down back over the weekend and review and see the points which it brings out. certain points receive emphasis and repeatedly come out. The point is very clear. What emerges in the Book of Mormon is this very clear message. So up to 46, I'm going to make a quick review the next time and show what they were talking about, actually. But we must remind you of this, too. When you read the book, when you read the Book of Mormon, anything like that, when you read a book, you must do exactly what you do when you see a play and so forth. Now, Shakespeare, we don't realize now how great Shakespeare was. Andy, this is a new discovery. The traveling actors of English players had a great deal to do with the Reformation on the continent of Europe. They set the pace at courts, at Lüneburg, at Heidelberg, in the Palace, in the Palatinate, Oppenheim, at various places. A writer by the name of Francis Yates has been investigating this idea now. These wandering players had an enormous influence in all the courts of Europe. They would go, and you would not make a sharp distinction between the reality of the court and the reality of the play. The players were in the court. Remember, when the players come in Hamlet, treat them according to their nobility. Treat every man according to his deserts, and who will escape whipping, he says. But you have to treat them like you. But the court itself was a theater. In fact, all the courts are stage in Egypt, and it is. Now, what was the theatrical part and what was the real part? You notice they overdressed. They dressed themselves in the most fancy way. They used overblown theatrical language. We call it the Elizabethan Renaissance. Then in the time of James, it carried on in exactly the same way, that produced Milton. But this mood of the courts and this mood of reality. And Shakespeare is constantly reminding us that when we read these things and when we see the plays, this is not the real thing. You have to produce the real thing. After he gives the most vivid, what I consider the most vivid picture, the most vivid description in words of an event that I can imagine, the description of night in the camp in Henry V there. He concludes, he says, "Sit and see, minding true things by what their mockeries be." He says, this is just a play. We're just putting it on, you see. You mind the true things by what the mockeries be, but you have to apply your mind to it. And that's what throughout Henry V, the chorus is always interfering and reminding you that this isn't the real thing, but you must make the real thing. And so we have the famous prologue at the beginning. Should I recite it? Yes, I should recite it. This takes you into the mood of the court. Oh, for a muse of fire would ascend the very heaven of invention. Kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then would the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, while at his feet, leashed in like hounds, should famine, war, sword and fire, crouch for employment. But pardon, gentle Zal, now he says, but this is only a play. And this is the best we can do. But pardon, gentle all, the flat, unraised spirit that has dared on this unworthy scaffold, the stage, to bring forth so great an object. Can I tell you about Henry and his wars and this wooden stage? Can we cram within this wooden O the very cast that did fright the Irenagian court? Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or can we cram within this wooden O, the Globe Theater was around, within this wooden O, the very casks that did affright the air at Agincourt, if a crooked figure may in little place present a million, see, by writing one, if you ask enough ciphers to which you can get a million out of it, he says, admit us ciphers to this great account. We put the one in, we'll be the ciphers and exaggerate it. And let us on your imaginary forces work. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now contained two mighty monarchies, who high uprooted and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts. You must make this story. Piece out our imperfections. Into 1,000 parts divide one man and make imaginary puissance. One man is going to represent 1,000 soldiers, so you make an imaginary army there. But you have to do it yourself. Imaginary puissance. Think, when we talk of horses, that you see them planting their proud hoofs in the receiving earth. For 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings. Carry them here and there, jumping over time. See, you jump over time and place, just as you do with the written record here. Carrying over time and place, he says, jumping over times, the accomplishments Turning, yes, turning the accomplishments of many years into an hourglass. You can take the events of many years and you can present them in 1 hour. You see, just as you can read it in a book. The same way. And as far as you must now deck our kings, it is your thoughts that now must deck our kings. You dress them up and put them in their proper places and so forth. And then jump over time, remove them here and there, and carry them here and there, turning the accomplishments of many years into an hourglass, for which supply admit me chorus to this tragedy and so forth. So there you are. He says, you have to do it. You have to do it all yourself. And when you read the Book of Mormon, you do that, you see. We skim through. We look for the high parts. We look for the heroic Moroni, Captain Moroni, and that's about as far as we look in the Book of Mormon. But that book is so full, and it's so exactly, so meticulously voracious. Everything is exactly the way it should be, the way it's presented. But the economy is so condensed. All this that gets in here, no, it's a miraculous work. Now, I see the time is almost, oh, are there any questions? Of course, everybody asks, what are you going to write for this course and so forth? But I'm not going to tell you. So, yes. Question, yes?
The room's important.
One of the great things of the Book of Mormon is the wandering people.
That's right. This is my migratory class.
So we had 280 Irene Science Center, starting Monday.
280 Irene? Oh, we're getting scientific.
Oh,
the first time they've ever given me a break. The last time I saw this. 280 Irene.
We just got to be able to get such a treasure possession of the university. There are folks here who haven't registered for the class. We please leave the spaces for people who have registered for the class, need the good money, need the credit. 280 starting Monday.
My 280 iron. Well, at last I've made it. I'm going to get the Nobel Prize.